From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, Tom Perata. His best-selling novel, Mrs. Fletcher, has been adapted into a new HBO miniseries. It's about life's transitions. The story follows both a single mother facing an empty nest and her son, who's off to college. Perata's previous novel, The Leftovers, also was adapted by HBO. Also, Booker T. Jones. In the 1960s and early 70s, he led the band Booker T. and the MGs. They also were the house band for the Memphis-based soul label Stax Records. Booker T. was in 11th grade with a paper route when he first started playing at Stax.
I was in a rush to get out of school and get my papers thrown and get over to Stax. That was my thrill every day, to get to go there and play music until, 10 or 11 o'clock every night.
He has a new memoir. Today's first guest is author Tom Perata, whose recent novel, Mrs. Fletcher, is being dramatized this Sunday as a new HBO miniseries. Catherine Hahn stars in the title role. Mrs. Fletcher, both the HBO series and the novel, are about major life transitions and the sexual transitions that accompany them. When the novel begins, Eve, a 46-year-old divorced single mother, is saying goodbye to her son Brendan, who's leaving for college. Brendan expects college to be a big beer and pizza party with plenty of girls. He's unprepared for the way he'll be called out for his sexist behavior. While Eve has been worried about the influence of porn on how her son treats young women, she finds herself turning to porn and is surprised by how much she starts to like it. Tom Perata spoke to Terry Gross in 2017 when Mrs. Fletcher was first published. Note to parents, although they talk a little about how the main character becomes drawn to porn, they don't talk explicitly about the porn she watches.
Tom Perata, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want to ask you to start by reading from the very beginning of Mrs. Fletcher.
It was a long drive, and Eve cried most of the way home because the big day hadn't gone the way she'd hoped. Not that big days ever did. Birthdays, holidays, weddings, graduations, funerals. They were all too loaded with expectations, and the important people in her life rarely acted the way they were supposed to. Most of them didn't even seem to be working from the same script as she was. Though maybe that said more about the important people in her life than it did about big days in general. Take today. All she'd wanted from the moment she opened her eyes in the morning was a chance to let Brendan know what was in her heart, to express all the love that had been building up over the summer, swelling to the point where she sometimes thought her chest would explode. It just seemed really important to say it out loud before he left, to share all the gratitude and pride she felt, not just for the wonderful person he was right now, but for the sweet little boy he'd been, and the strong and decent man he would one day become. And she wanted to reassure him, too, to make it clear that she would be starting a new life just the same as he was, and that it would be a great adventure for both of them. "Don't worry about me," she wanted to tell him. "You just study hard and have fun. I'll take care of myself." But that conversation never happened. Brendan had overslept. He'd been out late partying with his buddies. And when he finally dragged himself out of bed, he was useless. Too hungover to help with the last-minute packing or the loading of the van. It was just so irresponsible, leaving her with her bad back to lug his boxes and suitcases down the stairs in the sticky August heat, sweating through her good shirt while he sat in his boxers at the kitchen table, struggling with the childproof cap on a bottle of ibuprofen. But she managed to keep her irritation in check. She didn't want to spoil their last morning together with petty nagging, even if he deserved it. Going out on a sour note would have been a disservice to both of them.
That's Tom Perata reading from his new novel, Mrs. Fletcher. So I love that you have these two parallel transitions. The mother's transition, the single mother's transition, when her son is leaving for college, and his transition when he is the one who's leaving. And there's so many points in this book where I think he's being so oblivious to her needs. And I thought back to myself when I left for college. I wasn't thinking about my parents' needs. I didn't ask them, how do you feel now that I'm leaving home? It never would have occurred to me.
No, you assume they're all right. Their stories are set and you're the one who's on the adventure.
Exactly. And that's part of the point of your book. The mother story is not set. Like, she's questioning who she is. She's questioning her sexual orientation. She's questioning what kind of life she wants to have, how she should shake up her life. So what got you thinking about these two parallel transitions, the mothers and the sons, and how you could kind of join them together?
Well, the first part of it is, I think, that I've been kind of tracking my own life in my fiction. So when my kids were little and on the playground, I wrote little children based on those experiences. And when they were playing sports in junior high and high school, that gave me some of the raw material for the abstinence teacher. And the most recent era of my life has been this transition to the empty nest and to this post-parental moment of reflection. Like, okay, this huge project of raising kids is over. What does my life look like now? What does her life look like as well? But I never really write straight autobiography, and it seemed like a much more poignant thing to reflect on what it would be like for a woman whose son was the other person in her family. She really is alone when he goes to school. The empty nest really is empty for her.
Another thing that really sets off the story, it's on that day that she's about to drive him to college for his first day there. The girlfriend who her son has broken up with comes over for a visit. So the mother, Eve, goes out to get gas before driving him to college. When she returns, she hears that they're engaged in a sexual act, and he's giving her son is giving his girlfriend, really his ex-girlfriend, these crude sexual commands about what to do to him, calling her the B word. And Eve is just like appalled, like she's an enlightened woman. Like she hates this language. She hates everything it stands for. And she doesn't know how to have that conversation with him, and certainly doesn't want to have it with him on the day that they're parting, that he's going to college. But she wants him to begin college with the understanding that there's a difference between sexual relationships in real life and the soulless encounter he presumably watches on the internet. So what made you think about that? Does that come out of your life, too, of wanting to make sure that your children weren't learning crude, condescending ways of speaking to their boyfriend or girlfriend, from either learning it from friends, from television, from porn, whatever?
Well, I just think it's a really interesting and peculiar moment in American culture, because on the one hand, there is this kind of crudeness in the way that we talk. And on the other hand, there's this conflicting urge to really police the way that we speak. And so you see it with the B word, as you said. But so it's very common to hear women laughingly refer to their friends with that word. But then there's a sense that, you know, a guy should never say it to a woman. And you might say, well, that's a clear rule, but it's also a confusing rule. I think it's a shock for Eve to hear her son use this word in a sexual context. And I think she immediately thinks that he learned it from porn, because he certainly wouldn't have anybody modeling that kind of language for him in real life.
So, you know, she's assuming her son watches porn. And then once he's out of the house, she starts watching a lot of porn. And would you describe the kind of porn she's especially interested in?
Yeah, well, she receives an anonymous text that applies a certain label to her, which you and I have agreed to say she's a sexy mom, a mom who is sexually desirable. People will know the acronym. And she's offended by it. And it's a dirty text. But at the same time, she realizes she's not really sure about what the term means. And she goes to look it up the way we do. And she realizes that it's not quite the old Mrs. Robinson stereotype. It's a more neutral and possibly even complimentary term, suggesting that you may be older, you may be a mom, but you're still desirable. And in the course of doing this, she's led to a website that basically consists of ordinary women in their 30s and 40s, sending in, or their husbands or their partners, sending in videos of them engaged in sex. So it's highly amateur, and it's just about people saying, hey, this is me. Here, you can get a glimpse into my bedroom.
And she's surprised to find herself watching lesbian porn.
Yes, you know, she samples the menu, which is vast. And at a certain point, she settles on this lesbian porn as, you know, she's never thought of herself in this way, but this porn turns her on, and I think it leads her to sense that there are sexual possibilities in her world that she hasn't investigated yet.
In the sexy mother category of lesbian porn, you describe it as often beginning with a reluctant woman grumpily washing dishes or mopping the floor when the doorbell rings, and then a more confident woman arrives with a bottle of wine and a bit of exposed cleavage, and then the action begins. Did you watch a lot of this before writing the novel?
I watched enough to write the novel. Yeah, I did. And it was really interesting because, people have different responses to porn, obviously, and some of it is disturbing and some of it is just too much. But I did find that I was especially interested by this category of porn that involved a kind of a seduction because it was, I think, very different from, you know, the stereotypical male porn that would just sometimes just launch right in. You know, nobody wants any talking. But there was this sense that, you know, and I guess maybe this is a definition of a certain kind of female-friendly porn, that it was about two people connecting and about, it was about seduction, actually, very clearly.
And then in contrasting that with her son, he grows up in a boy culture where date rape doesn't seem like it's necessarily wrong to the boys. And if you're a guy who tries to intervene and stop date sexual harassment or date rape, you're going to be bullied for it. And it makes it very confusing for the boys, I think. And I'd like to know what you were thinking about when you were writing this character who is kind of subscribing to that kind of behavior and language and not really understanding what's wrong with it, even though he grows up in a family that wouldn't tolerate that kind of behavior.
Right, and he would say that it was wrong if you asked him about it. And I do think that I was really interested in the fact that we talk way more about consent than we did when I was in college.
When were you in college, by the way?
I graduated in 1983, and you know, I think that a whole sort of body of knowledge, you know, or just even the category of sexual harassment didn't fully exist. Like, I think I certainly knew students who'd had affairs with teachers, and that was sort of considered, you know, a little bit risky, but not beyond the pale. And you know, it just hadn't been codified as an offense at that point. It would soon change. But I will say, we didn't speak as much about consent. We didn't speak as much about sexual boundaries. I think we were closer to the sexual revolution. It was right at the moment when AIDS started to really change people's sexual behaviors. But it is interesting to me that, you know, students now have all these workshops and sessions about consent, and yet it does seem like the problem, I don't know if it's getting better. Statistically, it's hard to say, but it does seem that these guys are somewhat immune to all of the teaching, or they arrive at college still expecting to have that party that they've been dreaming about.
So the mother, Eve, wanting some kind of adventure in her life with the new freedom that she has, like she misses her son, she's alone. So she's both lonely, but she also senses she has this freedom and she wants to use it. And one of the ways she uses it, as we've discussed, is like watching pornography. But when she goes out to dinner with a younger woman who works on her staff at the Senior Citizen Center, she makes a pass at her, which is rejected. And this is the first time she's ever even thought of the possibility of having a relationship with a woman. And when she's rejected, it's kind of devastating. It's like, okay, I tried freedom. Like, what did I think I was doing? Like, apparently I can't do that. Apparently I've made a terrible mistake. Now I'm just really embarrassed. It's inappropriate to, she thinks, as like the boss to have made a pass at someone who works for her. And she says, like, that's sexual harassment. Like, why did I do that? And she's just heartbroken and disappointed in herself and also inhibited by the response that she's gotten. And I thought it was interesting for you as a male writer to try to really get deep into this woman's head while trying out for the first time a lesbian relationship.
Yeah, and I think it really was coming from that sense that once she starts looking at porn, certain things in real life look different to her. So she's watching all this porn where a confident, experienced woman is seducing a woman who is sort of reluctant, I guess is the word that's used in the book. There's a confident one and a reluctant one. And she's having this wonderful dinner with her employee, and it's kind of flirtatious, and they're discussing sex, and they're discussing gender, and she keeps feeling like the gravity of this porn scenario. It's like, oh, you know, which one of us is the confident one? Which one of us is the reluctant one? And somehow, I think this is really what the book is about. It's during this fall that most of the action takes place in, Eve is feeling her life becoming a kind of a porn scenario or a series of porn scenarios. And they do cause her to act in ways that she never would have acted before and ways that go against her principles. And one of the things that she says, and that I do think is absolutely true, is in porn, there's no such thing as sexual harassment. Anytime a kind of illicit situation is set up, it's so that the doctor can have sex with the patient. And so for a second, I think Eve mistakes her life for a porn scenario. And then when cold water gets splashed on her, it's like she's waking from a dream. Like, what was I doing? What was I thinking? And I am very interested in those moments when people do things that run contrary to their deepest principles, to their sense of right and wrong. Those are the moments, I think, when we find out who we really are.
Are you saying, too, that we sometimes confuse freedom with violating our own principles?
Yeah, that's really interesting, right? That's certainly how it is when we're kids, right? Where we're told you can't do this and you can't do that. And the minute you find yourself alone, those are the things you want to do. And so there is something in that kind of youthful rebellion against parental strictures that I think can still affect you when you're an adult. I remember talking to a friend of mine when our kids had first left for college, and he's a little bit older and his kids had been gone. And I said, oh, yeah, we're you know, going to have an empty nest, you know, pretty soon. And he just looked at me with his sort of wearily and said, well, the pressure to have sex is enormous. You know, it's like the kids leaving was like before when your parents left. Like, you're suddenly free. There's nothing stopping you. And I do feel like Eve is in this moment when, you know, she's alone. She's on her own. And I think she does want to have a sexual life. And she's trying to figure out how to make that happen.
Since you write about turning points in people's lives, what was a big turning point in your life?
Well, I do have to say that going to college was, going to college at Yale specifically after growing up where I did in New Jersey. At the time, I was really adamant with myself that I was not going to let this snobby Ivy League world change who I was, and that I could go there, kind of take what it had to offer and emerge kind of unscathed. And I really tried that. I had a girlfriend at home. I came home a lot on weekends. I always came home for the summers. I always had blue-collar jobs. But at a certain point in my late 20s, I suddenly realized, you know, I don't eat the same food as my parents anymore. I don't watch the same TV shows as them. I don't read the same books. I feel like there's this distance sometimes between me and older friends. I think that it's just in spite of all of my determination, I had been really transformed by the experience of going to this elite Ivy League college at that particular point in my life.
How did your parents and how did your old friends react to the changed version of you? Did your parents say, what happened to you? You're not our son anymore?
No, you know, my parents were great about it. I think especially my mom, she was the one who really encouraged my siblings and me to go to the best schools we possibly could. And I think she sort of accepted that transformation. I remember occasionally, my father has been dead for the past 15 years, but I do remember a few times when I was sort of just mocking some TV show he was watching. And I thought it was just a dumb show. And I remember that he turned to me with a really, he was both irritated and wounded, I think, by the fact that I was looking down on the show that he was watching. And you know, I still actually feel bad about that, and don't. That's the part of the transformation in my own life that I'm not crazy about. You know, the sense that the country really is divided by class, and by virtue of going to an Ivy League school, I did like sort of jump social classes, and it's real. You know, you there is a kind of condescension that can come with that I, you know, have to really fight in myself.
Well, Tom Perata, thanks so much for talking with us again.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Tom Perata speaking to Terry Gross in 2017. His novel, Mrs. Fletcher, has been adapted into an HBO miniseries of the same name. It premieres Sunday, starring Katherine Hahn in the title role. After a break, Booker T. Jones, whom the New York Times just called soul's ultimate sideman. He fronted the band Booker T. and the MGs. At the Monterey International Pop Music Festival in 1967, which made stars of such influential music acts as Janis Joplin, The Who, and Jimi Hendrix, Booker T. and the MGs was the backing band for another headline-grabbing act, Otis Redding. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bayer. From advances in health to innovations in agriculture, Bayer is advancing science for a better life. Because someone with heart issues should still be able to have their heart jump with joy. Because a farmer using less water should still be able to grow their crops. Because someone getting older should still be able to act young. At Bayer, this is why we science.
Our next guest is Booker T. Jones. In the 1960s and 70s, he led the band Booker T. and the MGs, which had several hits, including the popular instrumental known as Green Onions. He and his MGs also were the house band for the Memphis-based soul label Stax Records, and they eventually received a Grammy Award for Lifetime Achievement. But at age 74, Booker T. Jones isn't through achieving yet. He's still performing and recording, and he's just come out with another release. But this time, it's not a single or an album, it's a book. A memoir named after one of his memorable recordings called Time is Tight. It talks of his less-than-privileged childhood in Memphis, his passion for music and songwriting, and his career backing up such legendary artists as Sam and Dave, Albert King, and Otis Redding. Terry Gross spoke with Booker T. Jones in 2007, the year he was awarded his Lifetime Achievement Grammy. Let's start with Green Onions.
Booker T., welcome to Fresh Air. It's an honor to have you on our show.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
Would you tell us the story behind the track that we just heard?
Well, that happened something of an accident. We were at the studio as session musicians to play a session for an artist who didn't show up. So we used the time to record our blues, which we called Behave Yourself, and I played it on Hammond M3 organ. And Jim Stewart, the owner, was the engineer, and he really liked it, thought it was great, actually, and wanted to put it out as a record. And so we all agreed on that, and Jim told us that we needed something to record for a B-side, because we couldn't have a one-sided record. And one of the tunes that I'd been playing on piano, we tried on Hammond organ, so that, you know, the record would have organ on both sides. And that turned out to be Green Onions.
Now, you know, Booker T. and the MGs basically became the house band for Stax Records, and you played on a lot of their recordings. How did you become a member of the Stax house band?
Well, I was in 11th grade, and my friend David Porter knew that Rufus Thomas and his daughter Carla were recording one day, And I guess they had requested a baritone sax part on a song. And David thought of me. David drove over to the high school, came up with some type of hall pass and got me out of class and somehow came up with the band director's car keys and keys to the instrument room. So down we went to get the baritone sax out of the instrument room and into the borrowed car and over to Stax Records and through the door, and there I was.
Why don't we hear the recording that you played baritone sax on, which is your first recording for Stax. You want to introduce it for us?
It's called 'Cause I Love You by Rufus and Carla Thomas.
Okay, let's hear it. Rufus and Carla Thomas, the first recording that was that featured Booker T, but he wasn't on keyboards. He was on baritone saxophone, and Booker T is my guest. So you stayed, obviously. I mean, you were in 11th grade, you made this recording, and you ended up becoming part of the house band. How did they, was it hard to convince you to stay? Did you have to convince them that they needed you?
Oh, I convinced them. I actually had a paper route. That was my job in the afternoon. And no, I convinced them to try me out on piano and eventually organ. And I eventually played on an organ on a William Bell song, which they liked that part, You Don't Miss Your Water, on one of the sessions. So after I played that part, I had the job.
So what was it like going to high school and making records at the same time?
Oh, it was unreal. I was I was in a rush to get out of school and get my papers thrown and get over to Stax. That was my thrill every day, to get to go there and play music until, you know, 10 or 11 o'clock every night.
Booker T and the MGs is so associated with the Stax sound, such an essential part of what is described as the Stax sound. But how would you describe the Stax sound?
I would say it's a simple, earthy sound, you know, just born out of our blues and country and jazz roots and also gospel. It was a sound that, you know, we consciously tried to keep simple and with a lot of feeling.
Do you remember the first time you met Otis Redding?
Otis was a valet for a band from Georgia. He was carrying the clothes and doing the driving and going for the food and coffee and shining shoes or whatever he had to do to keep the band going. And I remember the day he pulled up with Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers was the name of the group he was working for. They just basically came in and he sat around and waited, and they did their demo for Stax. And after they did their demo, Otis asked if he could sing a song, which was a little inappropriate, but we allowed him, Jim and Steve Cropper and the rest of us allowed him to sing a song with us. And that song was These Arms of Mine. And so everyone was moved by that. So at that moment, he became Otis Redding.
So let's hear one of the records you made with Otis Redding. How about Dock of the Bay? Do you have memories of making this record?
Yes, I do have memories of that. That was a particularly special and hectic time. Otis was getting ready to go out on tour without us, and we had just returned to Memphis from the Monterey Pop Festival in Europe. Otis was disjointed and hurried and anxious and out of sorts, so he wanted to record all the time. He was insisting that we stay, you know, uncommon hours, and we were working late at night and people were probably sleeping at the studio, and it seemed like we were working around the clock.
Well, that's not how it sounds on the record. It's not a record that sounds like it was made by people who were tired and overworked. Did the mood change once you started recording?
I'm not sure that we were tired and overworked when we did this particular one, but the week was one that we recorded, I think, a whole album in just a few days. You know, the music always created its own energy once we started playing, so even if you were tired, you know, playing with Otis and playing with each other, the music just, you know, it just got a life of its own, and so the tiredness didn't matter.
Well, let's hear Dock of the Bay, Otis Redding, and my guest Booker T on keyboards on this recording.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting the evening come, watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away. Watching the tide roll away, sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I had nothing to live for, looked like nothing. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change, everything still remains the same.
Otis Redding, and my guest Booker T played piano and organ on many of the recordings on Stax Records, like the one we just heard. Were you close with Otis Redding?
Yes, unfortunately, yes.
Unfortunately, because he died in a plane crash.
Yes, he was a very close friend of mine. Yes.
Booker T. Jones speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Do you know how early you need to be to register to vote? How about the number to call if something's going wrong at your polling station? Or what about the best time of day to cast a ballot? NPR's Life Kit wants to get you ready for Election Day. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit All Guides.
Let's return to Terry's 2007 interview with Booker T. Jones, leader of the landmark soul band Booker T. and the MGs. He's just published a new memoir titled Time is Tight.
You wrote a song called Born Under a Bad Sign that I always thought was a much older song. I mean, it's such a kind of classic blues song. I figured it was, was around a whole lot longer. You want to tell us the story behind writing the song?
Yes. The company had acquired Albert King as an artist, and I was assigned to be his producer, and so we needed music for him. At that time, my partner was William Bell, my writing partner. William wrote the words, and I wrote the music in my den that night. That was one of my greatest moments in the studio, as far as being thrilled with a piece of music. I was very, very happy with the way that turned out.
What made you so happy about it? What do you particularly like about it?
the feeling of it, you know, it's the real blues, you know, done by the real people. It was Albert King from East St. Louis, you know, the left-handed guitar player, who was just such one of a kind and so electric and so intense and so serious about his music and involved with his with the lyrics and with the song. You know, he just lost himself in the music, and he was such a one of a kind character. And we had written a song for him, and we were doing it, and it was coming off, and I was there personally in the middle of it, so it was just exhilarating. You know, it's kind of hard to describe.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is Albert King, recorded in 1967, and my guest is Booker T, who's featured on this track. Albert King from 1967. The song was co-written by my guest, pianist and organ player Booker T, who co-wrote that song. Now, when you were playing at Stax Records, when you were in Booker T and the MGs, and you were the house band and making your own records, the South was still pretty segregated, but your band was comprised of African-American and white musicians. Did racial tensions from the outside world ever affect the band, or did you feel pretty well protected by that, from that?
Well, we were insulated, you know, as most Southern social institutions are. We were insulated because we had our little door there that we locked behind us at Stax, and nobody knew what was going on in there or who we were. So we weren't affected until we became pretty famous. Around 67 or 68, after Dr. King came to the city, and Dr. King was murdered in a place that was very close to us. He was murdered at the Lorraine Hotel, and that was our meeting place, and that was a place where we ate very often. So that affected us. But in general, we didn't have big racial issues there.
When you say the assassination affected you, did it? I mean, I imagine everybody in the band was pretty upset about it. Did it?
Mm-hmm.
Did it cause any?
What I mean
tensions
is, what I mean is,
yeah.
It brought outside attention to us and what we were doing there.
Right.
The fact that we were interracial, I like to call it a not too well kept secret that we were interracial. I think, you know, when we were playing music, that nobody really cared that we were interracial. I think they cared more about the music. I think whites and blacks both didn't pay too much attention to the racial aspect of it.
Did you feel there were times you needed to keep it kind of a secret?
Absolutely. The logistics of it demanded it. You know, we couldn't travel when we started without having two of us go get food. And sometimes those two were myself and Al, or sometimes those two were Steve and Duck. The other two would have to check into hotels. And,
right, because two of you were white, two of you were black.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So we always had to have, we were always in somebody else's territory, no matter where we were.
Mm-hmm.
But Steve and Duck and all of the white members of Stax began to love soul food, and I think they preferred to hang out at our restaurants. So we just really didn't have a problem as long as the rest of the world didn't have a problem with us.
Booker T. Jones speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org. Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting The Pulse, a podcast that takes you on adventures into unexpected corners of health and science. Plastic in the guts of deep sea creatures, crying after anesthesia, building your own internet. Each episode is full of fascinating stories and big ideas. The Pulse, available where you get your podcasts or at WHYY.org.
Let's return to Terry's 2007 interview with Booker T. Jones, leader of the landmark soul band Booker T. and the MGs. His new memoir, titled Time is Tight, has just been published.
You left Stax Records in 1969,
mm-hmm.
Which I think was the same year Stax was sold to Gulf and Western.
Mm-hmm.
Did that have any reason? Was that part of the reason why you left?
I left after Stax was sold to Gulf and Western.
Because it was sold, or?
Well, not because it was sold, but because it changed. Because the owners had control, and the owners were able to dictate how this company was run. And so they did that. They had every right to do that. They had big companies, and they knew what they were doing. They had Paramount Pictures, and they were a very successful company, and they decided that they wanted to change things in Memphis, and so they did. And the things that they changed made it lose its appeal for me.
What were the changes?
They changed the outlook. They made us... feel as though, well, they made us meet a quota as far as how much music we produced. That was the first thing that really affected me, because we were always able to have our down, you know, dry periods when we just couldn't come up with anything and when it just wasn't happening, and so everybody would get tense and, you know, we would argue and we just absolutely had no music. But then to come out of that, we would come up with something great. But Gulf and Western sent memos that caused us to change our production techniques to the fact that we had three bands going around the clock, and they wanted a certain number of albums in a certain time period. And so the president and the vice president, the people who were running the company, had to bring other producers in from other cities. They brought in producers from Los Angeles and Detroit, you know, because they had to meet these quotas, and it became a different company.
So when you left, did you leave on your own?
Yes, I did. I left all by myself. Nobody came with me.
What was your life like when you moved to Los Angeles?
Well, my life was uncertain for a while, but then I found friends in California that rescued me, and so I was able to survive out here.
And how did your musical life change?
Well, as I said, I found friends who were also somewhat nonconformists who rescued me. I met Clarence Avant, who at the time was one of the leading entrepreneurs, African-American entrepreneurs in the music industry, and he had a startup label that he was working with in California, and he had this guy that was building airplane toilets in Inglewood who had songs that he really loved. His name was Bill Withers. And
Bill Withers was building airplane toilets?
absolutely. And Clarence called up and sent Bill out to my ranch in Malibu, and Bill came up with, they came out there with a little tablet full of papers and an old beat-up guitar and started to sing songs. And he had some great songs in there, so I was able to work with him. And then
so you actually helped discover him?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
And I had friends that introduced me to Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss, and they were starting a record label, and
that was A&M Records.
We had a relationship, so I worked with them for a few years, and ended up producing and arranging albums on Rita Coolidge and various people on their label, and I actually ended up doing solo albums on A&M Records during that time, and I was able to survive.
And you produced Willie Nelson's, you know, now classic Stardust album.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, that was one of the reasons why I think I made the right decision, because I was able to work in some different genres that I wouldn't have been able to do at Stax Records.
Mm-hmm.
Stax wanted to keep it pretty much Memphis soul, which was fine, but Stax was not ever going to be, I don't think, a pop label or a country label, so I don't think I would have been able to take Willie Nelson there or Earl Klug. I don't think we would have been able to do jazz there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And your tastes are so wide-ranging. You wanted to work in a wide-ranging way.
Yes, it's one of my greatest disadvantages, liking so many different kinds of music.
Can I ask you about your name?
I'm named after my father, Booker T. Jones, Sr., and he was named after Booker T. Washington, and the name is Booker Taliaferro.
And how did you end up, like, dropping the Jones from the professional part of your name? Because it was like Booker T. and the MGs.
Well, yeah, the band needed a name when we recorded Green Onions. Al Jackson, the drummer, you know, was, you know, what do we call it? And he said, well, Booker T. and the, and they just came up with MGs.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little, this guy, this engineer on the song, Chips Moman, was driving a little British Leyland sports car. It's called an MG. I don't know if you've ever seen those.
Mm-hmm.
And he had it parked outside. He used to do tricks with it and everything in the snow, you know. And so they looked out the window, Booker T and the MGs.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You know, thank you for having me, Terry.
Booker T. Jones speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. He's just published a memoir called Time is Tight. On Monday's show...
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life.
Our guest will be Dan Pippenbring, whom the singer Prince had selected to help him write his autobiography. But shortly after they began working together, Prince died. Pippenbring's new book, The Beautiful Ones, includes the pages Prince had written about his childhood, adolescence, and sexual awakening, as well as Pippenbring's personal essay about working with Prince, and a collection of Prince's letters, photos, and lyric sheets. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our producer today was Sam Brigger. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley. What's it all for?